Hello and welcome to a special podcast edition of the Thomas Jefferson Hour with perhaps an apologetic tone. We've been getting some email.
We have?
Yes.
Well, we've done something we don't normally do. We've kind of suspended production on the Jefferson Hour for 5 weeks, I think, because we've been finishing a documentary film together about a former North Dakota governor.
Goodness, has it been five?
I think it's been five. Might be four.
You know, we had a really good run. I mean, we...
Well, we don't miss much, but this film kind of ate our time, and we had to finish it, and so we've apologized in several different ways. This is the last time we'll have to do that, because we've already today...
I broke a personal record.
We've begun producing new shows, and so that's... But this one will be a best of Jefferson, because this is the last week we have to cover ourselves, and now we're back in the saddle.
Except that you're off to the Mediterranean.
But I think we can cover this. I mean, it's...
We have some best of shows. And I mean, we have some archive shows with the wonderful Mr. Crystal that we can...
That doesn't happen very often.
Well, it happened once, but...
Well, people often ask where Bill is, and he actually is living in Virginia.
Uh-huh.
He does some performing as John Adams and Alexander Hamilton. And he does some guest preaching. He's a congregational minister.
Those old shows are just great, and they're really fun for me to hear.
Well, that works for me. That's kind of not a best of. That's more like a classical period of the Jefferson
Hour. Well, we don't
hour.
Do best ofs on the podcast because it would be like double loading the same
show. Right, you can't do that. So now you have to.
Well, could, but what's the point?
Yeah,
really?
So you're gonna search into the archival.
Well, you don't know this, but I do that occasionally to cover us.
Well, we're sure sorry that we've missed some. And it's, you know, there's so much going on.
There is.
An incredible summer in North Dakota. We've had a long, difficult spring. Now it's really unsettled with thunderstorms and tornadoes.
Well, that's right. It's always this time.
Wind.
The year that happens.
Isn't that something? I mean, it's been just a wild.
More than that, though, we've got a backlog of tremendously interesting questions from
people
listeners.
Are calling in questions. They're sending in questions.
And, you know, it kills me to not be able to answer every piece of email that comes Mr. Jefferson.
The next program, we did two programs now.
Uh-huh.
The next program we'll do will be listener questions.
Yes, we'll get back. We have a lot of questions for the president to answer, so we'll get back to that.
Well, it's such an interesting time in America, too. You know, you have the Obama presidency, which is in disarray for a lot of different reasons, but particularly because of the oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico, which, of course, he should not be blamed or praised for, but he's the president, and that's what we look to. And this is the time when Bill Clinton would have been a better president than Barack Obama because he would have felt our pain. I mean, he would have been down there feeling our pain.
Let's think about that. I mean, you said he should neither be
praised nor blamed.
The regulatory agencies that are overseeing offshore drilling have not changed since the time of the 2005 Dick Cheney.
The tendency since the Reagan Revolution in 1980 has been to deregulate America, and this
drill,
is what
baby,
happens.
Drill.
If you deregulate America, you do open the sources of new wealth. There's no question about that. But you're taking a risk, and now we see what that risk is. And so now, what will probably happen is we'll overregulate. That there are these cycles in American history.
Mm-hmm.
You got to get it right. And my own view on this, David, is a crazy one, but I think these things will happen.
You mentioned that, the cycle of chaos.
Chaos theory. I mean, just every – you have Abu Ghraib. Should that have happened? No. But these things do happen when you loose the dogs of war. You have the Valdez incident in Alaska, the oil spill from a generation ago, worst oil spill ever.
Till now.
Exxon Valdez, we'll never let it happen again, we say. Well, but then you go on and, you know, the industry gets better and the technologies are all taken for granted and no one expected a spill. No one wanted a spill. People thought it wouldn't spill. Now you get this colossal spill. So now you'll see technological advances that come out of this and you'll see regulatory changes that come out of this. But that doesn't mean there won't be more spills where you're pumping. I mean, what's the most shocking part of this to you? The most shocking part to me is the quantity of oil. You know, there are hundreds and hundreds of wells in the Gulf of Mexico. This one is dumping oil into the sea like crazy. If that hadn't happened, all that would have been brought up and refined and it already would have been burned. The consumption of the world of oil is unbelievable. We need literally tens of thousands of such wells pumping all the time to feed the industrial world's desire for oil. If you have that much stuff being sucked out of the earth, there are going to be accidents. And I don't know whether the Obama administration has responded in time, but I'll tell you what it hasn't done. And here's where Jefferson comes in. Barack Obama has not been an empathetic. He has not gotten to the soul of America's angst over this. And because he can't get there, I don't think he knows how to get there. I don't think it's in his character set. But because he can't get to our pain, our angst, our outrage, our need to be reassured in some way, he can't do it. Clinton could. If Clinton were down there.
He or she.
Either one, but he particularly. Bill Clinton was the master at feeling people's pain. And people laughed about it, but it's not funny. And Ronald Reagan was. Remember the Challenger disaster?
Yeah.
And, I mean, the great presidents embody the nation's mood when the nation needs to be soothed. Reagan was maybe the greatest master. Or angry. And Barack Obama appears to have some kind of a philosophical detachment that makes him superb in all sorts of ways. I'm not criticizing him. But he doesn't have this. He doesn't have the capacity to embody our anxiety and our anger. And because of that, he will be blamed. This is probably going to shatter his presidency.
You know, and it's interesting you say that because I think we as a people want so much for our presidents to do that we'll give them the benefit of the doubt. We'll urge them on. It's kind of like, you know, a popular musical performer goes onto the stage and all of the fans are there. And even if they don't do a great job, the fans still, you know, they want
them
to.
We're pulling for them. I saw the Grateful Dead once and they just sucked. And everyone pulled them up. The audience pulled them up into greatness
but
again.
But he doesn't seem to go. So what do you think, one-termer?
Well, I don't have any idea about that because that depends upon so many factors. But I'll say this much. He has been a profound national disappointment in an hour of need. And, you know, that's going to hurt him because look at George Bush. In my opinion, a weak president. But after 9/11, when he got up there with his megaphone, somehow he got the mood of the country. He embodied our anger.
Right.
And by doing that, he transformed a lackluster presidency into one that for a long time looked like it might have real legs because he figured out what we needed to hear. That's what great leaders do. They figure out what we need to hear, and then they don't fake it. They embody it somehow.
And the complete opposite side of the story is the man from BP who was at his yachting race.
Oh, where he says, "I want my life back." You know, that's of all the dumbass things you could ever say.
Right.
"I want my life back" is the single stupidest thing you could say, and he said it. And then to top that off, just to show us that it wasn't like a one-off piece of stupidity, he goes to yacht races off Britain. This is exactly what is wrong with leadership. Now, that's not true of Barack Obama. He's attending to this thing. He's doing what he can. Here's the paradox of this, David. You can't solve this problem without letting the bastards do it. Mm-hmm. The very people who caused the problem are the only people who can fix it. You can't send in the National Guard of Alabama to do this. You can't send in some wildcatter. You have to have the people who have the technological wherewithal to do it, and the only people who can do it are the very people that we have respect for.
I think it's really interesting. You know, my father was involved in the oil industry for years, and I understand these guys, and they always win because they have the perseverance and the attitude to do it, and they have the money and the time to do it. And you know, I'm not saying that in some judgmental form. I just accept that as fact. But I think it's very interesting that this would not have happened were it a Canadian well.
Because
Canada insists when offshore drilling is done that they drill a relief well at the same time, which is what we're waiting to have done. You know, they're by August, these relief wells, and that's the only way.
So the Canadians would have had the relief situation in place.
And why don't we have that in the United States?
Because we believe in money more than we believe in regulation.
Well, no, we have an unregulated oil industry that self-polices itself.
Worse than that. It's worse than unregulated. The regulators have shown to be cronies of the industry.
And can I pitch a documentary, another one?
Yes.
Just the other night I watched a show on HBO called Gasland.
Gasland.
In which I mentioned to you, and boy, I mean, you talk about how the people need to become aware of what's going on with I mean, you've said so many times, you know, I don't care as long as I got my cable. I'm okay, however you put that in. Yeah. People need to be involved in these sort of things. We really do. We need to mobilize and become aware of some of the things that are going on in the country.
Well, you would think that there would be a national, almost unanimous outcry for a better regulated offshore oil industry.
You would think
at the very least that would come out of this. That ain't coming out of this.
Well, it probably will, though. I mean, that's classic behavior, and I think you had talked about in a conversation before the show. We talked about, you know, after the Valdez, there was all this regulation that happened. You know, and you go back to, you know, Nixon did an awful lot for environmental, the Clean Water Act, and a couple other things.
But we've gotten complacent. And now the complexities of the industry are so great. You know, if this had happened in Texas, and these things used to happen in Texas. You remember that, where they'd go in and they'd drop with a helicopter and they'd find some couple on it and they'd keep putting more and more couples on it until they finally could get a faucet on it. And meanwhile, you know, a gazillion barrels of oil would spill and then they'd clean it up. This happened all the time. But underwater, you've added an incredibly difficult element to this. And so now when you see, I saw an animation of this, how the relief wells will work. And I mean, just think of this. They're going down like 5 miles altogether, and then they're going to penetrate the pipe at exactly the right spot. The technologies of our time are so absolutely amazing that you would think that something like this could never, ever happen. But your point about Canada, it won't happen there because they know what can happen. And because they know what can happen, they've built in.
At least they planned for it, you know.
But they assume that the worst could happen. Uh-huh. And so what's the Canadian approach, and they're socialists there, the Canadian approach is, what's the cost of drilling oil offshore? That cost is going to be borne at the front end. Instead of gambling and letting that cost be borne at the back end, they just say, you're not going to make quite as much money if you're drilling off Canada as opposed to Texas, but you're covering the possibility of chaos. The American approach is a wildcatter kind of Texas approach.
It's profit.
And so let's limit the regulatory apparatus to maximize the possibilities of profit and to rush production. And it works 999 times out of 100, out of 1,000. When it goes wrong,
it's pretty ugly.
It's ugly. Yeah. And so that we sneer at Canada, the heavily regulated socialistic culture. But look at the cost.
Even Mr. Jefferson sneers at Canada.
so does Theodore Roosevelt. Everyone sneers at Canada, but Canada does things right. And now I just saw, I think it's the cover of The Economist saying, Canada is now the world's economic miracle. People are looking to Canada.
Their banking system,
The Canadians, the same thing happened in our housing industry. The same thing happened in our banking industry. We deregulated radically and allowed chaos to ensue. And other cultures are in trouble too, but the Canadians don't do that. They're cautious.
It just seems like we risk so much as a people, ensuring that maybe a few people have a chance to grab the golden ring. And it, you know, that I have to be careful of not boxing myself into some sort of category here. But if as long as there's a profit motive in things like drilling for oil, that's the main motive. And I mean, I don't know how you remove the profit motive without going someplace that is dangerous to our way of life.
Well, I've got one going for you now.
Okay, good.
This is so cool. I've got two cars, one an ancient Jeep and one a hybrid Honda. And I had a flat tire in my Jeep.
Right.
So
I saw you biking here today. It was great.
That's why I had to.
Yeah.
I loved it, by the way.
But it's a long ride to the barn.
Oh, my.
Yeah.
And those gravel roads.
Yeah.
But so I had to change the tire in my driveway because it was that flat.
Uh-huh.
So I haven't changed a tire in my Jeep ever. So I get that back there, and of course the back's covered with junk and files and books and clothing and so on. So I finally excavate where the tire is, and I pull it out, and I've never used this jack, and it turns out to be quite a wacky jack. And and so eventually, but I have no tire iron. And so at some point, having never changed a tire, I'm lacking a tire iron. Whether I lost it somehow, which I doubt, or whether it just wasn't there. I don't know. So then I go to my Honda, which is right in the same driveway, and I pull its tire iron, and I change the tire in my Jeep, which is now at a tire shop getting fixed. So now I've got one tire iron for two cars. So this is chaos theory. So now I'm gambling. And instead of going to Napa Auto Parts, which any rational being would do, I have, so for a week now, I've been playing the odds. I've been playing roulette. And you know what's going to happen.
Sure.
You know what's going to happen. That's what we're talking about in the oil industry. You need a tire iron in both cars.
I wondered how you were going to get
there.
No,
but you do. And
pretty good.
If you try to share that one out and you play Russian roulette, you know what's going to happen. And so I've been thinking all week, why don't you just stop at Walmart and get yourself a tire iron before you have to walk 32 miles
at
midnight?
And why don't you?
I've been too busy. See, but that's how it works. So I'm going to out west this weekend to deliver something to the Badlands of North Dakota. I'm taking a tire iron in the car.
Right.
But there's going to be one in the other car too, because I'll forget this while I'm in Europe. And I'll come back. It'll be a blizzard. I'll be driving to do something in Minneapolis or something. I'll have a flat tire and I'll think, oh, how hard is it to change a flat tire? And then I'll be lacking a tire iron and it'll be the same problem that we're talking about. It's that kind of living on the hopes that the industrial paradigm will never let you down. That's what I'm talking about. That's what we do. You know, we leave our houses. I met a guy 2 weeks ago who left his house in Illinois, and the little thing in your refrigerator, the ice cube and cold water thing, leaked and wrecked all of his hardwood floors. He got a call. Imagine this. Like, he was on vacation. He got a call. There was a foot and a half of water in his basement from that little – we trust the industrial world way, way, way too much. Things can go wrong, and we don't build risk into our way of seeing technology.
Okay, well, with that, you've got a plane to catch.
I got a ship to catch. I'm going to Athens,
and I'm grateful that you had enough time so we could at least get some sort of an apologist's podcast.
Never
today.
Again for this year.
Well,
possibly not.
Let's say this fall.
Let's say we're going to do 8 shows in a row without a break.
No.
12?
Okay.
500?
We'll see you next time.
Bye.